guest in this hour of our program is a guest who has spoken with us a number of times previously. His name is Jonathan Berendt, and he is by profession a psychotherapist. First of all, Jonathan, good morning. Welcome back to our program.
Good morning, Bob. It's always fun to be a Boston sports fan on WFAN.
Well, there have been many different things that we've gotten into in discussion over the years with you on this program, but the one that area that has kind of dominated discussions has been talking about this area of social anxiety, performance anxiety, to some extent public speaking anxiety, and that's really been an area that you've pioneered psychotherapy work in. Why has your focus been in that area?
Well, that's what I discovered in 1978. I've been doing this for a long time, and I was fresh out of graduate school, working in a community center, and one of my associates said, let's start a socialization program for teenagers with learning disabilities. I had absolutely no idea what she was talking about, but that was how I discovered social anxiety. We would do the interviews with these kids, and then a very interesting thing happened. They would not come to the group, hence discovery of social phobia. So here I am 37 years approximately later, 10,000 patients later, with a lot of experience under my belt. And when you're talking about social anxiety, you're talking about the quintessential disease of resistance. If you're standing in a movie theater line, it's a good bet that out of every 10 people in line, two or three is experiencing some variation of social anxiety. Now, there are many different examples of it, but there are two basic types of people who experience this. One is the individual who has initiative. Initiative doesn't mean ability. It means the motivation to start up the process of healing. Everybody else does not have initiative. Here are some examples of individuals with initiative. One of my patients last week in Silicon Valley, a very brilliant, skilled professional working on, you know, very advanced security processes technically, is in a very intense meeting with an international clientele. And he explains to me, his words were, I had a soul-crushing panic attack. The adrenaline comes out of nowhere. It wipes him out. He's speechless. He's paralyzed in front of this group, and his boss has to take over the process. Now, when this kind of thing happens, the individual has experienced the trauma. They lose control, and then they obsess about it happening the next time. Another client, a lawyer involved in very intense litigation, was ruminating after interviewing prospective jurors, was ruminating on his disfluency to the extent that the rumination inhibited his ability to sleep. Okay, that's a very serious symptom. The anxiety is getting out of control. It's impacting sleep. And here is probably my all-time public speaking story. One gentleman, 50 years of age, was speaking. This was a couple of months ago. Was speaking live in front of a group of 16,000 people. Mm-mm. Imagine that. Mm-hmm. He's in front of the group, and he says, how many people know what a phobia is? So people raise their hands, spiders, flying, etc. And he says, well, I'm up here in front of you guys, but I want you to know that I have experienced public speaking phobia. And he was getting into the symptoms. My throat would close. My heart would beat fast. I would sweat. I feel like I had to run out of here. But here I am in front of you. And if I can do this, you guys can go out and make those phone calls that you've been avoiding. Now, in this person's case, he had a breakdown for 3 years where he was depressed and where he was avoiding all kinds of interactive engagements, public speaking. But now he's obviously back on the saddle. Now, at the risk of offending New York sports fans, the metaphor that I use when people come to me with a profile like this is that the patient is Tom Brady, and I am Bill Belichick. And the reality is, when you're talking about performance or social anxiety, the only way that you're going to resolve the problem is to go on offense. There's no way that a person can resolve an anxiety disorder while playing defense, but all too often that's what happens.
This idea of controlling social anxiety, is it controlling it or managing it?
It's both. There are two basic dynamics when you're talking about resolving performance anxiety. One is technique. Everybody loves technique. The technique here is, it's paradoxical, which means it's the opposite of what normally is. It's to make friends with your adrenaline. Now, what happens is when a person is experiencing anxiety and you're feeling the physical manifestations of it, it's adrenaline driven. So when it, at the first sensation of adrenaline, the anxiety sufferer goes, oh no, this is bad, this is not good. And what happens is that exacerbates the adrenaline, and that turns into what can be a panic attack. While technique is great, the only way that you're going to really resolve the problem is to do the core work, the underlying emotions, and this is what people don't want to do because it's really hard, embarrassment, shame, humiliation, the unconscious dynamics of anger that are present. It takes a lot of hard work. As a matter of fact, many people in my practice who are doing well in their treatment say, this is the hardest thing I've ever done in my life.
Why is it, and I literally just raised this issue or question with an earlier guest in this program, why is it that public speaking is such a challenge and such a great phobia for people in this country?
Because the person is exposed, and the greatest fear is the fear of being noticeably nervous, sweating, disfluency, fear of blushing, paralyzed speech. So when this happens, people think, oh, they can see that I'm nervous. The deeper thinking is, oh my goodness, they can see who I really am. And they put their personhood at risk. And the issue with resolving performance anxiety is you've got to separate from performance and personhood. And by the way, there are many clinical interviews at socialanxiety.com.
There's a lot of information that is shared there, and we will mention that site again in the course of our discussion. You've also, over the years, authored a couple of different books. Let's talk about the one on this subject specifically. Would you provide some information about Beyond Shyness?
Well, Beyond Shyness was my first book in 1990, and that is a wonderful self-help book for the basics of social anxiety and shyness. The issue back then was I was trying to make the point that shyness is too abstract a concept, and you've got to really get past it. The reality is that shyness is social anxiety. The question is, how much is it present? My latest book, which came out about 4 years ago, Work Makes Me Nervous, is a self-help program specifically for people who experience performance anxiety at work. Now, as I said before, there are two types of people who have the problem. One is the person with initiative, and the other is the person without initiative. So here we are, Valentine's Day. I would be remiss if I didn't bring up the example of intimacy anxiety. Many 20, 30, 40-year-olds who have intimacy phobia, it's something that I have referred to as involuntary virginity. One of the things that occurs is there's something that I frame as James Bond syndrome. The 30-year-old who has never had intimacy with the opposite sex says, well, when I do it for the first time, I have to be perfect. Mm-hmm. I call that James Bond syndrome. That is an example of obsessive compulsive personality disorder, which, by the way, a lot of the people with public speaking anxiety suffer. And it's based on perfectionism. Perfectionism is a sign of insecurity. While it's wonderful to be involved in the pursuit of peak performance, it's absurd to be paralyzed by fear of not being perfect, and that's what I see all too often.
So in getting that person, first of all, to recognize what is taking place, what usually is the initial reaction?
Well, people will do anything they can do to not come to treatment. Okay? I mean, it's the quintessential disease of resistance. And the biggest mistake that people bring into treatment is to be confused about how ingrained the problem is. So when you have, like the examples that I gave for public speaking anxiety, the person's career is in jeopardy. People don't come to me unless there's a significant problem. So mm-hmm. their career is at risk. There's motivation. So they reach out and they get help. But then you consider the 26-year-old who's up in his room playing 70 hours of computer games a week at the expense of healthy socialization. That person has no initiative. That person is not going to grow out of the problem. Therefore, it's important to recognize the avoidance dependence dynamic that is at play, which the mental health profession absolutely does not understand. And even though the 26-year-old is the primary patient here, it's the parents who have to take the bull by the horn, and they have to compensate for the child, for the dependent's lack of initiative, by starting the treatment process, or it will only get worse over time. I get a call from a woman who says, I'd like you to see my 26-year-old who has social anxiety. I say, sure, but I need to see you first. She says with indignation, why do you have to see me first? He's 26 years old. My response, why are you making the phone call?
All right, hold that thought. I want to follow on that point. We got a lot more to talk with you about. Jonathan Berendt is our guest this hour of our program on The Fan.
WFAN, WFAN-FM, New York.
Dress warmly if you're headed out of doors. It's very, very cold out this morning. We are in discussion with Jonathan Berendt on our program. He, by profession, is a psychotherapist. He's talking with us on our program. We've been talking about this topic of social anxiety. Before we paused for our update and messages, you were talking about this, the mother of a 26-year-old who had made the call to you, and you said to her, why are you making the call? And she said?
Well, she, at that point, didn't say anything because she was upset with what I was doing. See, mm-hmm. this is a very hard thing for parents to understand. So you've got the 26-year-old or the 30-year-old who's not functioning socially. To get to that point, and I'm not knocking parents, but the parents had to be quite confused as to what was going on, and many of them probably had their own anxiety issues. And what is very typical is they have polarized parenting in terms of their substantial differences in technique and philosophy. Another very important example of social anxiety is a condition called selective mutism. Now, what this is, in essence, is a speaking phobia. The person does not speak because of anxiety. There are almost as many children with selective mutism in the world as with autism. Thank goodness there's a lot of help in place for autism. There's almost nothing in place for selective mutism. The condition has totally baffled the mental health community. The child speaks normally at home, but in interactive situations, there's a pattern of total verbal shutdown. This is a variation of obsessive compulsive disorder, and I can assure you, these children evolve into adolescents and into adults. What's very disconcerting is when you get a 17, 18-year-old who could be functioning fairly well academically. A lot of these people are intellectually very smart, but their emotional intelligence is quite handicapped. And when you've got the teenager who does not speak, you have a very, very serious problem. In treatment, obviously, everything is confidential, but some people have given me permission to use their names. One such example, in working with the family, Kirk Reeder used to pitch for the San Francisco Giants. He won the most games as a left-hander. Their child suffered with this. They totally resolved the problem by doing treatment over the telephone, by the way. Mm-hmm. And I was joking around with Kirk one day, and I said, Kirk, did you ever have a bad game? And he said, yeah, I'm pitching again. He won 137 games, lost about 100. Okay, I'm pitching against the Rockies. 6-0, I'm losing, nobody out in the first inning. I say, how do you deal with that? He says, well, I have to pitch every fifth day, so what I think about is what do I have to do to be better the next time out? Isn't that the perfect winning psychology?
Mm-hmm.
So you got to ask yourself, what gets in the way of that psychology? There's two things. One is too intense an internal critical script, and the other is damaged self-esteem. And those are the core issues that have to be dealt with any kind of social and performance anxiety.
Why is it that the mental health profession seems to be so challenged when dealing with this?
Well, okay, number one, very good question. Number one, this is the quintessential disease of resistance. This is not the type of thing that people talk about over a cup of coffee or a drink, because social and performance anxiety is based on the emotions of embarrassment, shame, and humiliation. So most people with this problem do not seek help. They avoid for as long as is possible. The more they avoid, the more ingrained it becomes. Okay, then we have the response of the mental health community in general is, okay, and I know I'm generalizing here, but it's an important piece at the risk of being too controversial. So what's happening these days is when you're talking about psychotherapy, the first thing that comes to mind is, okay, we're going to do CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. And many professionals who come from that background say, okay, you come in with social anxiety, this is short-term therapy, you're going to get better in 12 sessions. What I see with that kind of response is that that is such a grossly overused cliche, it's that type of thing that confuses the consumer. What I've seen very clearly, and I do believe I've worked with more social anxiety sufferers than anybody in this world since 1978. I didn't plan to get into it, but I did discover it as, you know, that original story I told you. This problem becomes very, very ingrained. For example, another condition is called erythrophobia. That is fear of blushing. One young man, and the story is, you know, in detail at socialanxiety.com, one young man, age 22, committed suicide, jumped out of the fifth story of his college dormitory because of pathological blushing. It's horrific. The person can't control the blush. They say, people can see who I really am. They can see I'm flawed. They can see, you know, that I'm lying, whatever it is. So shortly after this particular suicide, CNBC was quoting the world's expert psychiatrist in blushing from Chile, who wrote a book on it. And he says, the only way that you can really, the best way to control this is by a procedure called a sympathectomy, where doctors will invasively cut nerves, because it is an involuntary response. Go to the website socialanxiety.com. There are at least a half a dozen interviews with people who have suffered erythrophobia who got all better without surgery. It's a matter of how you think and dealing with emotions and dealing with adrenaline and taking on the paradox of making friends with adrenaline. But this is what the mental health profession as a whole does not understand.
And what about the idea of medication, because that very often is the approach with medicine these days?
When I started my practice in 1978, I started with biofeedback and therapy, treating stress-related disorders, the purpose of which is, let's not use medicine, let's get people off of medicine, and that's the approach I like to take. However, what I have seen and learned is that there is a wonderful way to use medicine. When we're talking about social and performance anxiety, the key characteristics are, when you determine how severe the problem, how much is the person avoiding? How much pain is the person in with the panic? What is the degree of the obsessive? That's a key word. The obsessiveness, the rumination. Are there compulsions at play? And the right way to use medicine is when these characteristics, along with depression, because that's very comorbid. You use medicine, and about, I would say in my practice, about 30 to 40% of the people do use medicine. You use medicine to facilitate the therapy. It's like when you're riding a two-wheel bike and you're learning, you start with training wheels. So you're on the medicine, and that facilitates the treatment. And then when a level of success and happiness has been sustained, you methodically go off of the medicine. What is absolutely wrong is when people think that medicine is a cure. And it's very disconcerting when people come into my office and they've been on medicine for 10 years and they have no clue what's going on. So there's a right and a wrong way.
Hmm. When people are so focused on, locked into the online world, that basically they don't have a life outside of that. How often does that occur? To what extent does that occur?
Do you know that texting has replaced talking as the most common form of communication?
I teach in college classrooms. Definitely, I know that.
Well, it's mind-blowing. And it's baseline these days. You know, when I was growing up, we did talk, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what happens is that, and this is really serious. People joke about it, but it's really serious. What happens is with texting and the technology in general, there's a wonderful and there's also a dark side, is that collectively in society, the neural pathways, N-E-U-R-A-L, the neural pathways required for processing verbally as a social skill are extremely diminished. There we go back to the selective mutism issue. It is just absolutely astounding as part of the avoidant personality. Again, avoidance is one of the ways you measure the degree of the problem here. How people live on the internet, in the video game world, it's like crack. And they lose all reasoning about socializing when it's a compulsion. And a lot of social anxiety is based on not only obsessive compulsiveness, but obsessive compulsive personality disorder, which gets into the whole perfectionism thing. But what happens is they lose themselves in that world. And as long as they have that to go back to, they are able to detach from reality. It's at epidemic proportions.
Okay, if they're that detached from reality, then how can they develop, for lack of a better term, social skills, the ability to interact with other people?
They won't. They will not. And that's a sad fact. Again, what I said is, you know, a lot of people come into treatment and the biggest mistake to confusion about how ingrained the problem has become. So when you've got the typical, and there's so many people I work with like this, the typical 25, 26 year old who is avoiding socializing and who is so dependent on the technology and the video games, I don't start by working with that person. What I do is I start with the parents, and because of the avoidance dependence dynamic, even when the person is 26 year old, and I explain to the parents that when I am working with your dependent and we're doing certain thinking and dealing with feelings and talking about all this, they're not going to want to do it because they have become so skilled in detaching. The process of attachment causes anxiety. So I get the parents on a team so that the dependent can't run away from what I'm trying to do because they're all going to want to do that. The critical word here is detachment. As a defense mechanism, people with anxiety disorders learn how to disconnect from thoughts, feelings, as well as the situations that induce the anxiety.
And when you're dealing with someone whose world essentially is online, then how do you approach them with treatment? I mean, they're not going to physically come to you, I'm assuming.
Well, 90% of the work that I do these days is by Skype and telephone, because actually most of the people that I work with are out in the New York area at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that when there is such an overdependence on technology, what I try to do is to reduce that dependence. A lot of the times, that is where the person, that's where effective use of medication can come in, because when we're taking them somewhat away from the overuse on technology and going into an interactive world, that's where the anxiety and the excessive emotions come into play, and that's where medicine can be used constructively if implemented the right way. But again, it's a struggle. Once the child of whatever age is so locked into that, they don't want to give it up. It becomes a compulsion. So we're talking about challenging or working with the compulsion or the addiction of avoidance.
Jonathan Berendt is talking with us on our program on The Fan this Sunday morning. As he has mentioned, socialanxiety.com is a website where you can find out information about Jonathan's work. There's some good resources available there. We've also mentioned earlier in our discussion, he's the author previously of Beyond Shyness, How to Conquer Social Anxieties, and also his book, Work Makes Me Nervous. Overcome anxiety and develop the confidence to succeed. He is with us this hour of our program. I'll tell you what we'll do in the home stretch of our program. And yes, we're on till 8 this morning. Hey, we're back! Yay! In that final portion of our program, we'll try to work in some thoughts from some of the folks listening to us. 877-337-6666 is our number here at The Fan.
WFAN, WFAN-FM, New York.
Yippee! We're back. We're in discussion with Jonathan Berendt on our program. He is talking with us about this topic of social anxiety. There's a whole lot of areas to go in discussion. I also mentioned what we'll try to do is to open the phones up. You want to join us with a question? You can. And WFAN's toll-free line, 877-337-6666. It's brought to you by Mohegan Sun, full of action, full of possibilities, full of life. 877-337-6666 is our number here at The Fan. You want to join in our discussion. When we talk about a day like today, Valentine's Day, for somebody who experiences social anxiety, what are they going through?
Well, they're probably detaching. So they might not be experiencing anything. Remember, the person with all of the with hardcore social anxiety is disconnected and detached from that. But what are they going through? Okay, so here we have it's a time for relationships and dating and whatever. So the people who are not, they're buried in their own world and technology. And many are getting depressed because of that. There's loneliness. That's what they're going through. The world is functioning all around them, and they have learned to detach. Again, when one is going to resolve this problem, they need to implement the concept of attachment, thinking about the issues, dealing with the emotions, and that's what the people turn themselves off from and disconnect from. You know, I want to give some real specific advice here, two pieces that can really help your listeners, I think. So the first is for the people with initiative. And I gave a few examples of public speaking before. The number one thing that you can do to help yourself is when you experience this is the adrenaline control technique, and it's a couple of basic steps. Number one is realistic expectations. That means when you go into the interactive challenge or the public speaking challenge, your adrenaline is going to be there, so don't waste any time hoping it won't be. Okay, number two, which is the hardest, is to accept it with the interpretation that the adrenaline is your friend and source of power. And then steps three and four are one or two diaphragmatic breaths with the thought or the image of the surfer with the wave, surfing the wave. The wave represents the adrenaline. You go with it, you're in control. You don't accept it, the wave will smash you around, hence a panic attack. That's my advice for the people with initiative, with performance, and social anxiety. For the people without initiative, the kids with selective mutism, the adults who are avoiding socializing, over-dependent on computer games, etc. My advice for the parents is, I know that you want to nurture your children. Okay, but nurturing all too often is confused with rescuing. There's an interview at socialanxiety.com. It's called Parent Resolves Break Your Heart Syndrome to Cure Selective Mutism. So this mother would talk for the child and think for the kid and read her mind and everything when seeing the child in distress or experiencing anxiety. It's the normal instinct of the parent to rescue the child. You've got to change that around a little bit. Nurturing means provide support, promote growth. When you are able to challenge and support your kids as early as possible, you will truly be nurturing empowerment, because social anxiety is an extremely insidious problem that becomes more and more ingrained over time.
Jonathan Berendt is talking with us on our program on The Fan this Sunday morning. Rick Wolf's Sports Edge follows our 8 o'clock update, and Ed Randall's Talking Baseball's along after our 9 o'clock update on The Fan. You want to join us in discussion, 877-337-6666 is our phone number. We head to Tom in Queens. Tom, good morning. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to The Fan. Tom, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Excellent.
I just wanted to talk about a little bit about my experience that I'm 25 now, and I kind of lived through social anxiety. But the interesting thing, I was wondering, because I was always either misdiagnosed or confused in the sense that I was always very capable at public speaking. And in fact, I feel that I'm above average at it, but I feel that's because I'm able to disassociate or detach from every individual. I'm not looking at any particular individual, whereas my social anxiety is more on an individual and smaller group basis. Mm-hmm. Is that...
Yeah, that's very common. That's very common. And there's an interview that you'd be interested in at socialanxiety.com entitled Gifted Salesman, Public Speaking Performance Anxiety. And what it is he describes kind of what you're describing. He's really okay in these big groups, but when he gets into a smaller group, you know, 10, 15 people, and he's closer to the audience, that versus 50 or 100 in the audience, that's when his anxiety kicks in, because there's more intimacy. And again, it's like, so there's two levels of fear there. One is, oh, people can see I'm nervous. And remember, being noticeably nervous is what, you know, is the killer for most people. And then the deeper thought is, oh, because I'm noticeably nervous, people can see who I really am. So it's this dynamic that leads to avoidance, which is phobia, or over-dependence on substances to repress the feelings, or the use of medication. All too often that happens in a non-productive manner.
Correct. Like pornographic addiction.
But that's related. But no, that is related. Thank you for sharing. That is related. Let's go back to the 26-year-old who's up in his room, not only playing the video games at the expense of healthy socialization, but there's a lot of the pornography addiction, too. Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you for your call this morning, Tom. All right. Next, we go to John in Westfield, New Jersey. He's been holding for a while. John, good morning. Welcome to The Fan.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for taking my call this morning. Quick question, Doctor, on the use of beta blockers for kind of public speaking engagements. I found it to be quite effective, but I'm not sure if you're...
No, I thank you for that. It's a great question. Okay, so beta blockers. There's another interview, a couple of interviews there, socialanxiety.com, effective, productive use of beta blockers. Okay, so here's the deal. When a person is using a beta block, this is my philosophy. When a person, and you can read about this in Work Makes Me Nervous, that's the self-help book for performance anxiety. When a person is using a beta blocker here or there for high-level challenges, that's a wonderful thing. You know, you take a beta blocker 45 minutes, an hour before the presentation. Yeah. What is not good is, and people, you know, a lot of professionals, doctors say that beta blockers are not addictive. Well, they can be psychologically addictive. The person who says, well, I'm going to Toastmasters, I send a lot of my people there for the purpose of learning to make friends with adrenaline. When the person takes the beta blocker at Toastmasters, that's not good. You're not achieving anything. You've got to make friends with your adrenaline.
Yeah.
So the answer to your question is, when used the right way, they're good. But I work with many people who are overly dependent. I work with one guy, a high-level accountant, who always kept beta beta blockers in his pocket, and along with other similar medicines, benzodiazepines, so that whenever there was a spontaneous interactive challenge that he wasn't prepared for, he would pop one of these things. Okay, so the whole thing with resolving performance anxiety is you've got to make friends with adrenaline. Therefore, you have to feel it. The beta blockers inhibit the process of feeling the adrenaline, but they can be very effective when used the right way.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you for your call this morning, John, and your patience on the phone, and for everybody who's joined us in discussion. Jonathan Berendt is talking with us on our program On the Fan this Sunday morning. He's joined us here in our 7 o'clock hour. Socialanxiety.com, that's socialanxiety, all is one word, .com website, where there's a lot of information along the lines of the things that Jonathan has shared with us thus far in our discussion. After our 8 o'clock update, Rick Wolf is along with the Sports Edge program. Ed Randall's Talking Baseball follows our 9 o'clock update on the Fan. What keeps you going doing this?
Well, I am getting older, let me tell you. That is a very good question. I mean, I'm 65 years old right now. I just got my Medicare card. What keeps me going is there's a lot of passion here, okay? And the ability to change people's lives is a very motivating factor. That's what keeps me going.
Well, that's certainly good to hear, and I'm glad to hear that the passion is still there with what you're doing. It's very obvious when you talk about this work. You've authored a couple of books we've mentioned in our discussion, Beyond Shyness, How to Conquer Social Anxieties, and Work Makes Me Nervous. The challenges that lie ahead for you, what do you see next?
That's a good question. I don't really have the answer for that, but you are reminding me of what the most important question of all here is, especially when we're talking about this subject. And I asked you this once before, do you know what your most valuable asset is? And I surprised you with that question. The answer is, just think of it, do you know what your most valuable asset is? Oh, it's my retirement account, my house, my career. No. Your most valuable asset is time. Time is not elastic. It does not stretch. People with this type of anxiety are the world's best procrastinators. The biggest mistake that is made, parents see patterns of anxiety, shyness in their kids. Oh, the kid will grow out of it. Well, mm-hmm. That does not happen. The earlier that you get the right intervention, and this is what is really motivating to me is, you know, for a long time, the average age of the 10,000 people that I was working with was about 30. What I love now is you get these kids in who are 4 and 5 years of age with selective mutism and obvious anxiety. I don't work with the kids directly. I teach the parents what to do. I teach the parents how to be the therapist. It is wonderful when you can get the anxiety under control before it works its way insidiously. And it is very insidious into the personality.
Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us on our program. Certainly the best continued with your work.
Thank you. One more thing. Go Celtics. Go Red Sox.
I knew he was going to slip that in.
WFAN. WFAN-FM. New York.